So we're starting a series today on the life of David called Broken Hallelujah. And we've picked the life of David because David was this deeply flawed individual who God used in meaningful ways. And so we're going to be in the life of David for 6 weeks. And this series is really going to be based around and built around the next conversation afterwards. Because we believe that circles are better than rows. And so this series will not do its full job and justice for you in your life unless you're doing life with other people who call Harbor home. We've started several small groups recently. You know, we've been talking about community for the last 3 weeks. And so there's still a chance to join a group, to get involved, to do life, to take this conversation further. On that, in the words of Walt Whitman from his Song of Myself, do I contradict myself? Very well, then. I contradict myself. I am large. I contain multitudes. And I love this as like an introduction. It's a poetic introduction to the life of David because that's who David was. David was this king. He was a poet. He was a shepherd. He was a warrior. He was an amazing father at times. He was a terrible father at times. He was a murderer. He was a rapist. He was someone who sought and tried to listen for and obey the leadings of God. And he's the only person, in the Bible says, was a man after God's own heart. And it says it twice. So David was this guy who at times was the best of figures and the worst of figures. You know, what I love about David is, do we want our heroes to be bastions of undefiled perfection? Or do we want them to look like us, to be flawed in all the oh-so-flawed ways that you and I are? I mean, if you're looking no further than, if you want moments of impact and meaning in their life mixed with deep flaws that at times they were moments from, if not wrecking their life from their flaws, you have to look no further than David. You know, one of the things that rabbis would look at when they're looking at characters in the Bible and when people first appear in the Bible, you know, what their first words are. And there's this tradition that when someone's first words, when they spoke the first words in the Bible, that would sometimes give a perspective or a behind-the-scenes look at who this person was going to be and what their life was going to look like. And so when you look at David's first words, actually, it's in a passage that Kelly's going to cover next week, but David's first words were in 1 Samuel 17:26. And in this moment, David is looking at Goliath. You've probably heard of David and Goliath. David is looking across the valley of Elah at Goliath, and Goliath is cursing the people of God and God himself. And this is what David says. These are David's first words. It's just a picture into who David was. David asked the soldier standing nearby, "What will a man get for killing this Philistine and ending his defiance of Israel? And who is this pagan Philistine anyway that he is allowed to defy the armies of the living God?" Like, I love this because it's this both and. It's like these are David's very first words anywhere in the Bible. And he says, if I step up, what would I get out of this? And who does he think he is to defy God? He is this both and. He is contradiction himself. He is at times the best of characters and at times the worst. With all this in mind, he's the only person in the Bible to have the phrase, a man after God's own heart, used about him, and it's used twice. To understand the point of David, one has to first understand the counterpoint to David, which is David eventually became king, but you have to understand the king who was king before David. And that king was a man named Saul. And so there was this king, Saul, and he was king before David was king. And just like when you, to understand David, you have to look at the first thing that says about him. To understand Saul, you have to look at the first thing the Bible says about Saul. And in Saul, the king before David, David's predecessor, in 1 Samuel 9:2, it says this. His son Saul was the most handsome man in Israel, head and shoulders taller than anyone else in the land. And so you have David, and he's going to be the focal point of our series. But before you get to him, you have this guy Saul. And Saul was king before David. And this is why Saul was chosen to be king. And what you have here is it kind of encapsulates the man who was the predecessor to David. And Saul was this very, very impressive guy. It said he was handsome. He was tall. If you're going to judge a book by its cover, you're going to select Saul. Because he's tall and he's handsome, he's jacked, he has a winsome smile, he's ruggedly good looking. Like this is the guy who came before David. But the problem with Saul is this is all that Saul offered. And that Saul was this king who always looked out for Saul, who was obsessed, single-minded for how people viewed him and making sure that he had a positive sort of like a approval rating among the people, that people he wanted, he was single-minded and needing people to approve of him, to look at him and be impressed by him. This is who Saul was. All of Saul, the king before David's choices, revolved around making Saul look good. Saul was obsessed with winning battles, so much so that he would undercut the way people viewed him just so that he could have the glory of winning battles. I mean, he would when he would go around his country, he would take young men into his army against their will. In 1 Samuel 14:52, it says this: so whenever Saul observed a young man who was brave and strong, he drafted him into his army. We have to understand, as this culture at this time, it's like this agricultural family dynamic where all the larger multi-generations of families would live together, and they had these family farms. And when you took a strong young man out of it against their will, you're not just taking this young man against his will, but you're sort of crippling this family farm at the same time. But Saul was only obsessed with him and his looks and the way people viewed him and whether or not people were impressed with him. And so he would damage, if not ruin, if not starve a family, if it meant his army would be a little stronger and he could win more battles. And so then you go on in Saul's sort of kingly reign, and there is a country that is oftentimes battling with Israel, and this the prophet at the time, a man named Samuel, comes to Saul and says, Saul, if you go to battle against this country that is causing you problems, then God will bless you and you will win this battle. But I need you to do one thing. Normally what happens is your soldiers will go and you'll go into battle and you'll win these battles and you'll take all of the precious stuff back with you, and that's how soldiers make their way in the world. And you'll take gems and gold and silver, and you'll take livestock, and maybe you'll take slaves, this is how soldiers make their way in the world. But I need you to not do that. I need you and your men to not take anything back from this battle. And so one very important thing. Normally what happens when you go into battle with another country is if you win, you take their king as like your prisoner, like that's your trophy, and you put it's like a trophy on your mantle, but it's your king in your dungeon. I need you to not do that. So when you go into battle, Saul, you're going to be successful, God is going to bless you, but don't take stuff, don't take livestock, don't take their king. But under the pressure of his soldiers, because he needs people to like him, Saul did the opposite. He took stuff, he took livestock, he took their king. And then Samuel came back, the prophet, to approach Saul. And he's like, Saul, he's looking around. I see stuff. I hear livestock. Here's their king over here. You were instructed not to do any of this. And Saul starts to make excuses. He says, oh, I took the livestock because I wanted to make sacrifices to God, and that's why I did it. And Samuel's like, to obey is better than sacrifice. Saul, you were not obedient. This day, God's going to remove his presence from your life. He's going to remove his blessing from your leadership, and he's eventually going to remove you from this country. And in that moment, Saul's response reveals everything you would ever need to know about the king who was king before David. Yes, he was big and he was tall. He was the tallest man in the country, and he was strong and he was impressive. But his response reveals everything you would ever need to know about him as king. It's so telling. In 1 Samuel 15:30, he says this: then Saul pleaded again, I know I have sinned, but please at least honor me before the elders of my people and before Israel. He's like, I get it. I know I've dropped the ball, but just do me a favor and still honor me in front of people. Because I am all about appearances. I am all about what people think of me. I'm all about whether or not I am impressive. And this is Saul's whole thing. It's his whole reason for existing. And he is the counterpoint to David. So Samuel, the prophet at this time, he tells him God's presence and his blessings are going to be removed from Saul's life. And it is. And Samuel is in mourning because he knows there's going to be a transition in leadership. And God comes to Samuel and says, hold on, it's okay. The next king is going to be my guy. The next king is going to be a man after my own heart. And what I need you to do, Samuel, is I need you to go to the province of Ephrath, to the Ephrathites, to the town of Bethlehem. I need you to find the house of Jesse, and I need you to anoint one of Jesse's sons as the next king. By the way, if that sounds familiar at all to you, it's because last year, if you call Harbor home, we did a series on the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth takes place in Ephrath, in the town of Bethlehem. And Ruth would have been Jesse, this Jesse's grandmother. And so you have Samuel, and he's going into the region of Ephrath looking for the next king after Saul, because Saul was obsessed with appearances, and God can't work with that. And so he goes into this town, and it gives province, and he goes into the town of Bethlehem. And it's funny, the leaders of the town elders of Bethlehem come out to meet Samuel, the prophet, because they knew that he spoke for God, and if he said what he said goes, if he's entering town, it could be problems for the town of Bethlehem. And so they meet him outside of town. They're like, "Hey, man, hey, Samuel, I know you're coming to town. It means you have a message for us from God, but we just want to make sure that you come in peace, so we're good here, right?" And Samuel's like, yeah, we're good. We're good. I need to come to town, and I found a man named Jesse, and to anoint one of his sons as the next king. I'm like, okay, well, come in. Yeah, that sounds good. We were worried for a second, but that's all right. You can come in. What you need to do is you need to take Moses Avenue down to Alpha Street, and it's the third house on your right. You can't miss it, right? That's Jesse's house. And so he goes down to Jesse's house, and he approaches Jesse, this prophet Samuel, and says, "Jesse, I need to anoint one of your sons as the next king." And so, I picture this in like in the Sound of Music style, you know, where like Jesse's like, you know, and they all come like marching out, you know, and they line up, all the sons come. That's a joke for some of you older heads in the room. Some of you, I probably won't get that one. And so the sons all line up here, and all the sons of Jesse line up, and Samuel walks in front of them one at a time, and as he sees them, Samuel, he knows that one of these young men, one of Jesse's sons, is going to be the next king. And he's going to be the king who's the counterpoint to this king who's obsessed with the way he looked and how impressive he was. He takes one look at the oldest son in 1 Samuel 16:6, and he says this. He says, "When they arrived, Samuel took one look at Eliab and thought, 'Surely this is the Lord's anointed, because he's tall and he's impressive and he's muscular, and that's clearly what we're looking for in a king.'" But Samuel was going to do the exact same thing that he had just done with Saul. He's going to get the exact same sort of king. He saw the most impressive, the oldest, the tallest, the highest potential, the highest ceiling on his life. He said, "Surely this is the one." And I want to get God's response to him in 16:7. "So surely this is the Lord's anointed." But in 1 Samuel 16:7 it says, "But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Don't judge by his appearance or height, for I have rejected him. The Lord doesn't see things the way that you see them. People judge by outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart.'" This idea of people judging at the outward appearance, but God looking at the heart, this is both encouraging and supremely challenging, right? It's encouraging because if you aren't the biggest and the best and the brightest, if you aren't the tallest in the land, well, then that's not what God looks for in your life. But it's supremely challenging because God actually looks at who you really truly are. He's not impressed by what you present. He's not impressed by how you come into church. He's not impressed by you. It looks like to everyone on the outside you have your ducks in a row. He sees your heart. It is both supremely invitational and supremely challenging because he actually truly sees who you are underneath. Like at all the games that we play with one another, the way that we posture and present with one another, none of this sways God at all. Man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. And this person, this next king, that in this context of this narrative, this next person, he's not going to be the biggest and the tallest, the most impressive. He's not going to be like Saul, the tallest and the bravest and the strongest in the land. He's going to be someone whose heart is set on fire by me. That's who God can use. When you look around and we posture and we present ourselves, we present ourselves as the best possible us that we can muster. And it does not sway or impact God and how God interacts with us at all. Because this is who God can use. God can use the one whose heart is set on fire by him. And so we keep going in this story in 1 Samuel. And we're going to keep reading. So then Jesse told his son Abinadab to step forward and walk in front of Samuel. But Samuel said, "This is not the one the Lord has chosen." Next, Jesse summoned Shemaiah. But Samuel said, "Neither is this the one the Lord has chosen." And so one by one, Samuel has come to this town in Bethlehem in the region of Ephrath to the house of Jesse, and he knows one of Jesse's sons is going to be the next king. And Eliab comes first, and he's the biggest and the most impressive. He's like, "Oh, surely this is the one." And God's like, no, I don't look at the impressive outside. I look at the heart. And so then it's Abinadab, and he walks in front of Abinadab. He's like, no, this isn't the one. And then it's Shemaiah. Maybe Shemaiah's the one. He's like, no, he's not the one. And so he goes, son, no. And he's confused. And he's like, "Jesse, I'm sorry. I'm confused. God told me that one of your sons was going to be the next king. But these are your sons, right? I mean, these are all your sons, correct?" In the same way, all seven of Jesse's sons were presented to Samuel. But Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen any of these." Then Samuel asked, "Are these all the sons you have?" In verse 11. And then the last half of verse 11 says this: "They're still the youngest," Jesse replied. "But he's out in the fields watching the sheep and the goats." And this, and what's fascinating about this is this word youngest here is this word hakatan. H-A-Q-Q-A-T-O-N. Those of you in the front row, you should know better, because it's like some of the times these Hebrew words, when you say them, you got to like spit from your throat. It's like hakatan, right? It even kind of sounds like what you're doing when you're saying the word. But it's this hakatan. And this is this word that it says for youngest. And this word hakatan, it's not just youngest, but it's the person with the lowest potential, the lowest ceiling on their life, the easiest to leave out, the least significant, the smallest. The closest thing that we have in our sort of vernacular would be to call this person the runt of the litter. The unimportant one, the insignificant one, the hakatan. So insignificant, so unimportant, he didn't get invited to this moment. Think about that for a second. Like Samuel, this prophet who's going to come and anoint the next king of your country, and it's going to be one of your father's sons. And so your father comes in and says, "Samuel's here, and one of you is going to be king of the country. And I need you all to get ready, put on your best clothes, clean yourself, and you, David, while this is happening, take care of the sheep." You're not needed at this. It's obviously, clearly not you. And so then it happens, and Samuel comes, and he walks, no, he walks in front of this one, no, walks in front of this one, no, walks in front of this one, no. I'm so confused. Is there no one else? Do you have no more sons? We have the hakatan, the runt, but he's with the sheep. You definitely don't want him, do you? And Samuel says, "Call for him, bring him in." And you can imagine, and I can imagine that you can see how where this is going, where the rest of the story goes. That this is the one that God calls, this is the one that Samuel anoints, and this is David. And up until now, it actually hasn't said David's name. It's referenced him twice. It said that the next person who's going to be king is going to be a man after God's own heart. That's God speaking to Samuel. And then Jesse speaking to Samuel says, "I have another one, but he's the hakatan, he's the runt, he's the insignificant, he's the unimportant. He's the one that has no shot at being next king. And if he was king, Lord help the country." He's the hakatan. These are the two times that David's been referenced up until now in the story. His name has not been listed yet. What's fascinating about this, though, is that even his own father was saying this about him, said this about him. "Oh, I mean, I've got David, but there's not much to him. He's easy to miss. He's easy to leave out. He's unimpressive. The ceiling on his life only is so high. He's out with the sheep and goats because that's kind of his ballpark in life." What's fascinating about this is the same guy who I said earlier this David, this HaKatan, he's going to be the one who's going to be the musician, the poet, the king, the warrior, the shepherd, the man of unshaken integrity, the man who repeatedly listened to and for God's leading. He's going to be the same guy who's going to end up murdering and raping and being a bad father, but he's going to be the same one who's a man after God's own heart. You know, like, how is it possible that his own father, when viewing him, said that it couldn't be him, he's the HaKatan. And he's the one that God's going to use. Actually, that if you consider that much of the life of Jesus is redundant in the Gospels, the four books about Jesus' life, then there's more writing on the story of David than anyone else in the entire Bible. There's 66 chapters devoted only to the life of David. And this is not including the portion of the Bible and the Psalms that he writes, the poems and the songs of worship that David writes. That God uses and records this person to this level, and this is where he started. That even his own father looked at him and said, oh, the runt, the unimportant, the insignificant, the HaKatan? Which makes us question, when someone says that about us, when has someone said that about you? When has someone called you, maybe not in exactly these words, but the moral of the story is the same, the HaKatan? When has someone said about you, oh, that person, there's no. You don't understand. That person is this, they're this, they're this. No. When has someone spoken that over your life? Think back on your life. Take a moment. In this room with lots of people, but they can't hear what's going on in your head. At what point has someone looked at you and said, oh, no. Not them. It couldn't possibly be them. They're fill in the blank. Sometimes when people do that in our lives, it's not even what they say. Like, their actions speak louder than their words. They overlook us. They leave us. They abuse us. They view us as a worthy collateral damage. They think they can use us for whatever they want. Sometimes people are cruel for the sake of being cruel. And it's their actions speak louder than the words ever will. I mean, David's father, Jesse, his actions spoke louder than his words. I mean, he said the words, but his actions spoke even louder. Because yes, he called him the HaKatan, but he also didn't invite him to this moment. Like, you realize that? Do you realize what this probably did in the soul and the heart of David, this young man, the youngest of his siblings? Hey, one of you is going to be the next king. So everyone get ready. And David, go take care of the sheep. From his own father. We look back at our lives. Maybe it was your parents, like David. Maybe it was someone who in your life. Maybe it was someone older. Maybe it was someone in your family. Maybe it was a friend. Maybe it was a boss. But many of us have, at different points in life, someone has looked at us and either said, oh, no. Not you. You're the smallest, the least significant, the one of lowest potential. Or their actions spoke louder. They walked away from, they abused, they overlooked, they... You are the HaKatan. And so the two points, the two times that David has been referenced up until now, both of these things, there's two questions we have to ask ourselves. The first time David is referenced, it's as a man after God's own heart. And this phrase, a man after God's own heart, like there's two ways you can understand this word after. The first after is to pursue. It's to run after. It's to chase after. It's to pursue this heart. So the first way you can understand it is that David was someone who was pursuant of God's heart. He was after God's heart. The second way we can understand after is inspired by or to model after. So, you know, you can model yourself after someone else. You can model yourself after someone who inspires you. And so this passage says that my next person is going to be someone after my own heart. And I think in the Bible isn't really clear on which of these two things, definitions for after, this is referring to when it says that David is a man after God's own heart. Because I believe it's both. I believe that David both modeled, is inspired by, loved the way that God loved, viewed people the way that God viewed people, approached people the way God approached people, worshiped God the same way that God wanted to be worshiped, and he was inspired by God. He modeled his heart after God. He pursued God. He pursued God with his heart. You know, this pursuing of God, like sometimes like in people's life when they're pursuing God, it comes across like they're trying to earn God's love. But this is not someone who's trying to earn God's love. This is someone who knows that they love God and God loves them, and they're pursuant of that heart, like two people who've been married for a long time and still madly in love. They're just like pursuant over each other's heart, and they're still chasing each other's heart because they're still in love. And this is the after I think this is referring to. When it says that David is a man after God's heart, it says both David is someone who pursued, who chased after the heart of God, and was inspired by the heart of God and modeled his heart after the way that God loved. This is the first time that David is referenced. And the second time that David is referenced is this Hakatan. Oh, you couldn't possibly mean the Hakatan. And so when has someone labeled you the Hakatan? That's my second question. The thing is, like when someone looks at you and they label you and they're like, oh, you couldn't mean that person because they're the Hakatan. What they're doing is they're looking at you and they're gauging you, and they have a value system in their mind and their heart. And on that value system, you don't rank. You don't add up. And maybe it's because you actually don't rank on that value system. Not that that value system matters. And maybe it's because they just want to, they have found one value system where you're lower than them on it, and that's the one they're going to use for you. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. Because that's not how God views us. And the way that God interacts with us and loves us and views us is far more important than anyone else's. Isn't it funny that when we're going to choose between us and someone else, as far as what's best for us, preserving us, we will always choose us. But when it comes to choosing how we think of us, what we think or what someone else's think, we'll always be impacted and view ourselves through someone else's lens. It's when someone says something about us, you know, and it's painful. They call us the Hakatan, or they leave us, or they abuse us, or they're cruel to us for the sake of being cruel. Like that begins to ring and sting in our soul. So much so that we believe that it's true. The root of Hakatan, it's H-A-Q-Q-A-T-O-N. The root of this word is Q-A-T, cut. And that means self-loathing. See, what happens in our life is someone looks at us and say, oh, you're the Hakatan. And we hear it. And maybe they walk away from us, or they leave us, or they abandon us, or they pigeonhole us, or they... And so it rings in our soul and stings in our soul. And so it doesn't just become what they believe about us. It becomes what we believe about us. And this is what Hakatan, at the core of it, it's not what someone else thinks, it's what we believe to be true of us. That we begin to loathe ourselves because someone else had said something that rings and stings in our soul, like David's father said of him. And so do you see yourself the way that, I don't know, you've been told you should, or people have said about you, or do you see yourself through the lens of the worst things anyone's ever said about you? Or do you see yourself the way God sees you? Because man looks at the outward appearance. Man looks for the Sauls, the tall and the impressive. Man looked at the Eliabs, David's older brother. Oh, surely this is the one. But God looks at the heart. And so when you think of yourself, do you think of yourself the way other people have said, of what other people said about you, or what God knows is true of you? See, man looked at the outward appearance, but God looked at the heart. That is both supremely invitational and supremely challenging. So in 1463, Augustine Deduccio was commissioned by the city of Florence to carve a sculpture that was going to go in the center of town. Because Florence was this town that they wanted to be a center for like culture and art. And so they wanted a new sort of like centerpiece for their art landscape in town. And so they commissioned Augustine Deduccio. And Augustine, he was like a relatively well-known sculptor at that time. This was his most famous work. This is a sculpture of the mother of Jesus, Mary, which is, I guess, fine in sort of like a Han Solo frozen in carbonite kind of way. It's fine, right? It's okay. But this is Augustine Deduccio's greatest, most famous work. And so the town of Florence wanted Augustine Deduccio to give them a new centerpiece sculpture that was going to go in the center of town. And so they commissioned him, and they were going to go buy a slab of marble for him to carve his greatest work into. And as he went to the province of Carrara outside of Florence to find the marble that he wanted, he saw this large slab, and it was white, and it was kind of grayish white. And this was going to be the slab that he was going to create his life's work out of. And so he had them carve out this long, tall, skinny, 19-foot tall slab of granite, this Carrara granite. And he was going to carve it out, and he's going to take this into his where it was going to stand, and he was going to carve it, and it was going to be his legacy. And after they carved it out of the side of this mountain, this 19-foot slab of granite, it fell over. And a 19-foot hairline crack made it all the way through this entire slab of granite. And so Augustine de Duccio, in this moment, said, I can't possibly use this slab of granite. There's a crack in it. Like, this is your fault, not mine. You carved it too skinny. I can't possibly use this granite. And so in that moment, they said, no, this is your only granite you're going to use. You can either use this or you can go home. There's no more granite for you to use. This is your problem. This is your fault. This is the one you wanted. This is it. And so he quit. And so a decade or so later, the town of Florence asked another sculptor to come in, and they said, can we commission you to have a new centerpiece sculpture for our town, that we own the center of town, and we're going to use this granite right here? Like, yes, I will be your sculptor. And so they brought the sculptor, and they showed him the slab of granite that they were going to use for this sculpture. And he saw the hairline crack, and he said, no way, I can't possibly use this. And like, you know what I'm saying? This is the only granite we have for this project. This is the project. This is the granite. Can you do it? And he said, no. And so for 38 years, that slab of granite sat in the exact spot where it landed when it fell over, with the hairline crack obviously visible. For 38 years, it was this point of tension and frustration between the quarry and the town of Florence and the art community. And it was a point of embarrassment that this piece of granite that was going to be art at some point for 38 years just sat there unused. And then 38 years after Augustine Duccio first picked out that slab of granite, they commissioned a new artist. This is an up-and-coming artist. He hadn't really made a name for himself, but they could tell he was gifted. This artist was 26 years old. He didn't know any better than to know that this granite could not possibly be used. And so they commissioned this young artist, this 26-year-old, to make this sculpture that was going to go in the center of town. And they weren't sure, because he was young, he's kind of new on the scene, but he had done some good work, so they were going to use this guy. And he is too young to know any better. They could only artist they could get to use this granite. So this artist spent the next 3 years chiseling away and buffing the surfaces of this 19-foot, eventually 17-foot, piece of granite. This artist was named Michelangelo, and that granite that cracked and fell on the ground was his statue, David. And isn't it fascinating that the exact piece of granite that was too cracked to use in the hands of a lesser artist was the exact granite that David looked at and thought masterpiece? It's the exact same thing happening in our lives. When we go through life and someone says of us, oh, you don't mean that person. It couldn't possibly mean that person. You don't know what they've done. You don't know where they've been. You don't know how little potential they have. You don't know what little they have to offer. It couldn't possibly be them because they're the Hakatan. But in the hands of someone else, that Hakatan is not embarrassment. It is masterpiece. You know, an art historian says of this David statue, he says, without any doubt, this figure has put in the shade every other statue, ancient or modern, Greek or Roman. To be sure, anyone who has ever seen Michelangelo's David has no need to see anything else by any other sculptor, living or dead. The greatest sculpture ever. Michelangelo himself said of the statue, I saw the angel in marble, and I carved until I set it free. So the granite in the hands of someone else was garbage. In the hands of Michelangelo was masterpiece. Is this not a picture of what God does in our life? He uses David, the Hakatan. And he says more about this Hakatan's life than any other character ever in the entire Bible. He uses him as one of the greatest king the country has ever seen. He uses him as a poet who writes some of the Bible's most beautiful worship songs about him. He uses him as a warrior to set people free. And he started out uninvited to his own family's coming out party. The piece of granite that was trash for someone else is this person's masterpiece. So the next time someone looks at you and says, "No, thank you." No, your potential is too low. There's nothing good about you. You could not possibly be the next one. You are only a Hakatan. You look at them and you say, "You're right." In your eyes, I'm nothing to write home about. But in the hands of a different artist, I am masterpiece. Exactly where I'm supposed to be, exactly who I'm supposed to be, and exactly what God can use to do with my life, what he intends to. So for 38 years, that granite sat there, garbage. But in the right hands, it became this, the statue of David. God, and again, uses the overlooked, the left out, the low potential, the abused, the left behind to do amazing things. 1 Corinthians 1, 27, 28 says this, and I'll close. Instead, God chose those things the world considers foolish in order to shame those who think they are wise. And he chose things that are powerless to shame those who are powerful. God chose things despised by the world, things counted as nothing at all, and used them to bring to nothing what the world considers important. If you've ever been told what you can do for God, the impact you can have in your life, the legacy you can leave behind is very low, your potential is low, there's nothing you can do, God can't use you. And if that has rung and it's stung in your soul long enough that you've begun to believe it, I'm here to tell you through the life of David that there is no such thing as a Hakatan. That David, once and for all, removes the word just. You are not just this, you're not just that, but that you are just the one that God can use. And in the hands of a different artist, you can just be masterpiece. Let's close in prayer. God, I thank you for this story. David, I thank you for what you've done. I thank you for the way that you use David, that he is the one who even his own father wanted to leave out. He's the one who was Hakatan. He was the one who was insignificant, who was the runt of the litter, and yet he's the one that you chose to write much of your word, to write much of your word about, to inspire, to write worship songs that many of us who have beloved from the book of Psalms. From these inauspicious beginnings, you have done great things through him. And this is an invitation to all of us, the way that we understand and think about ourselves, the way that we view ourselves, the way that we understand ourselves, that we are not just Hakatan. We are who you made us to be. And so that in your hands, In your hands, with you carving, with you making us who you have us to be, that we are not just waste, we're not just garbage, we are not just confusion or this granite sitting on the ground as an embarrassment, but we can be masterpiece. We can be used by you to do amazing and great things for your name. And so we love you and thank you in your name. Amen.